Good morning. Welcome to the Bikecast. Just going to put some air in the tires while we try to figure out what to talk about today. There are a lot of topics in my head, both great and small, and a couple of them have nice overlap. I think I might head for that territory. Elisa and I watched a documentary the other day called Iraq for Sale, which was interesting on a number of levels. Primarily, and this goes back a couple podcasts to my reference to Schmedley Butler, primarily the interest about how wars are waged, at least in part, or maybe even by and large, for the interests of the suppliers of the military. And it's sort of come to a crescendo now, which is what's revealed in the documentary. Back when Schmedley Butler was in the Marines, the U.S. military, say the Marine Corps, purchased food at premium prices from farmers, and then that food was moved and prepared and served by members of the military. But in our current day and age, the service as well as the material is provided by private contractors. Even the transportation is provided by private contractors, and that was probably one of the more tragic elements covered in the movie, was about the truck drivers who were getting ambushed. Yeah, one incident in particular was covered in great detail, where a convoy of truck drivers fresh from the United States were sent through a combat zone, and a lot of them were killed, and the ones that came back were suffering, not surprisingly, in ways similar to the way combat veterans react. Another aspect of the film talks about the tremendous amount of waste. So these private companies are billing in all kinds of absurd ways and charging absurd amounts to ship products from the United States, some of which can be found locally in Iraq. At one point, they're talking about $40 or $80 for an energy drink of some sort that one company is serving in the cafeterias. Well, throughout the documentary, which again, I think was worth watching, and it's very interesting, but the documentarian doesn't bother to ask the question, you know, what would be different if those truck drivers had been wearing camouflage American uniforms? How would that be any less tragic that a U.S. serviceman driving a truck got killed on the road as opposed to a civilian truck driver? A number of reasons might even spring to mind if one doesn't stop to think that fundamentally these are both people paid to go to a very dangerous place to do a very dangerous job. A common defense of the position that soldiers should be in those places instead of civilians would be that the soldier's job is to fight in combat zones or to drive trucks in combat zones or what have you, and part of the job description is the danger, the chance of death, and so forth. Where the civilian contractor should have a reasonable expectation of not being in that role. And that's, of course, a reasonable argument if one's operating under the paradigm of specialness or otherness around the U.S. military, instead of seeing things at the human level, at the level away from the abstract notions and abstract entities that layer on top of a situation in order to mask the ethics of a situation. The only real difference between the military and civilian truck driver, as I talked about in the last podcast, is the civilian truck driver is probably being paid about 10 times as much money. That pay difference is due largely to the intangible rewards of being a soldier, and that is having the U.S. government as an employer, colloquially known as having served your country, and with the status of being a veteran, having protected America's freedoms, and so forth. The civilian truck driver does not get that recognition, at least not as readily as a military veteran. And so, when you're trying to hire them, the civilian's going to have to be offered more money for the job. So to return to my objection, or my objection's a bit strong, my fantasy world follow-up question of why is this any more tragic than the death of a military truck driver, I don't really think there's a very good answer. I think the only way you can have that difference is if you have accepted that people in the military have some intangible, magical, other property. And that's a very common position, that they have legitimacy, they can kill without being held accountable, and so forth. But some set of magical properties that makes the death of a soldier in a combat zone something less tragic than the death of a civilian paid 10 times as much to operate in the same combat zone. And the same sort of double blind, or whatever you want to call it. It's not double blind. The same sort of blinders are on with respect to the private contractors who are, as a matter of objective fact, making money hand over fist in no-bid contracts in Afghanistan, Iraq, and anywhere else where the U.S. military operates. Back when I was a youngster, they used to say the same thing about the military itself. The military procurement process that paid $1,000 for a toilet seat or $500 for a Phillips head screwdriver. And as I alluded to earlier in this podcast, Smedley Butler talks about these same beneficiaries of military spending as far back as the First World War in his telling. But of course, they existed during the Civil War. The character of the war profiteer is in almost every piece of historical fiction. I'm sure this is a feature of imperial armies, or even armies in general, back to the very beginning of expropriation of the peasant class. So it's a little disingenuous when it's brought up as a new thing as a result of privatization, so-called. So, to sum up, Iraq for Sale. An interesting movie, an interesting documentary, but it seems to go through great lengths to focus blame on the privatization of the military rather than the fact that the military itself is a criminally unjust institution that is engaged currently in occupying some 100-plus countries around the world for the benefit of stability around corporate interests and at the expense of the American working class. Let me try to tie this in here, although it's sort of a different subject. One part of it is the same, which is the obviousness of the potential for abuse. Potential so large that it cannot help but be fulfilled in any system founded primarily on violence and coercion. This is to do with the TSA screening policies that have recently been in the news, recently as of late November 2010. There's a lot of focus on political focus from the media and congresspersons about the constitutionality of being x-rayed down to your skin in order to board a airline flight. And the other side, of course, warning of the perils of terrorists who are just waiting for security to be let down an inch so that they can rush in and destroy all of civilization on planes. The constitutional question always makes me laugh because the Fourth Amendment against unreasonable search and seizure was probably violated first about 8 minutes after the Constitution was ratified. So yes, of course it is unreasonable search and seizure. So are 99% of police search and seizures. The interesting thing that's getting less press but is relevant to us today is that Michael Chertoff, former Homeland Security guy, is an executive for the company who's selling the backscatter x-ray machines. If you have any interest in following up on this, I'm not really sure the details too much myself, but I'll post it in the show notes. In any case, it's fairly typical, besides being rampantly criminal and ridiculous, it's also typical and even inevitable that this sort of arrangement is found. Powerful people swimming in an infinite pool of resources with no accountability and no oversight, and largely not even any powerless but vocal critics. There are a few, though, and I will link to them in the show notes as well. And you can drop by if you have some questions, comments, or insights. Leave them in the comments section on my website, jaddavis.com, jaddavis.com. And until next time, thanks for listening.